The Keystone Pipeline is the prime example of a shovel-ready project that's been through every approval process here in Washington. Every option is on the table. We're going to do everything we can to try to make sure that this Keystone Pipeline is, in fact, approved.
That's House Speaker John Boehner speaking on Fox News Sunday about how he wants to get the Keystone Pipeline built. This following President Obama's rejection of the proposal last week. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, January the 24th. Speaker Boehner also said that Republicans may once again attach the Keystone Pipeline proposal to an extension of the payroll tax cut. We will talk with two different guests during this hour, getting a case for and against the Keystone Pipeline, and we will wonder where you stand and what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our first guest is William Yateman, Assistant Director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a nonprofit group dedicated to limited government, free enterprise, and individual liberty. It supports the Keystone XL pipeline. And William Yateman joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So why do you support, why do you think the United States needs this pipeline?
Well, I'll note right at the outset, you had stated that the president had rejected this pipeline, and it wasn't an unequivocal rejection. Even the final sentence of the State Department's recommendation very much left open the door for TransCanada, the company that wants to build this pipeline, to reapply. So wasn't unequivocal. It was more along the lines of a punt, and that was actually what the president did in November. He punted this decision. He was poised to make it. After 3 years of review, he was poised to make a decision, and he decided not to do so until after the 2012 election.
I'm glad you clarified that. I just misspoke. He did say there is not enough time to say yes at this time.
Precisely. And were the TransCanada, and as they're expected to do, to reapply with a proposed a new route in mind, then who knows what the president would decide. Certainly, I work for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We're a libertarian think tank, free market think tank. We only cover economic issues. We don't touch the social stuff. But it's by law, the president's decision must be based on whether this is in the national interest. And certainly, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, and that on behalf of my organization, certainly seems as though it's in the national interest. It's the number one diplomatic priority of our closest friends, our neighbors to the north, Canada. And more fundamentally, as Speaker Boehner intimated in that Fox interview that you led off with, it would create 5,000 to 6,000 shovel-ready jobs. It would actually create wealth. I mean, this is a $7 billion investment that wouldn't necessitate a single penny of taxpayer money. All that it requires is the government to get out of the way. So certainly, I mean, given these wealth creation aspects, given the job creation aspects, given the fact that it's a diplomatic priority of our close friends to the north, and indeed given the fact that this is an important commodity, that of oil, and ultimately refined products, one that this country depends upon, it would expand our supply. And certainly as a free marketer, if you expand the supply of something, you decrease the price. It's effective. So that is it certainly seems as though it's a no-brainer. And even the Washington Post, a paper of record certainly in Washington, D.C., used just that language, quote, no-brainer. I'm kind of in asking what was the president thinking and deciding to punt this decision yet again.
Well, he was saying that it's not clear that this isn't going to pollute the route that this pipeline takes.
Well, that is certainly the explanation he gave. However, there was a very comprehensive 3-year review conducted by the State Department pursuant to the National Environmental Protection Act, NEPA. And they found that wasn't the concern. One wonders whether or not the president actually believes that. It certainly seems as though the decision was politically motivated. Were he to approve the pipeline, he would alienate environmentalists. were he to deny the pipeline outright, he would alienate labor, both of which are important constituencies of his base. So in order to keep emotions high, in order to keep enthusiasm high in the lead up to this 2012 election, it made perfect political sense for the president to punt. And certainly that certainly seems to be the case. I mean, I can't put my mind in the president's, and perhaps he does believe that it's only this environmental concern, despite the 3-year review and his own administration determining only last, I believe it was September, that the environmental concerns did not warrant a decision, that this was not in the national interest. So the consensus seems to be, certainly inside the Beltway, and without, for that matter, that this is a political decision, that this wasn't really an environmental decision per se. It was a decision to keep two elements, important elements of his base, kind of in a holding pattern so that he doesn't anger either one in the run-up to the 2012 election.
So what's the big harm in not having, not approving this pipeline immediately and taking a little bit more time to make that decision?
Well, we've actually already seen job losses due to this delayed decision, and that is important. There's a, I forget the exact name of the company, and please check out the blog I run, globalwarming.org. I've got the facts there. But there's a steelmaking company in Arkansas that was responsible for producing the steel for the 500 miles of this pipeline, and due to this delay, they said that they had to lay off, this was 2 weeks ago, I'm sorry, last week, 60 jobs. So we've already seen job losses. But more importantly, I mean, what is the delay? The economy isn't so red hot right now. And as of 2008, or 2009, I should say, a priority for this president was shovel-ready jobs. And this is just that. These are shovel-ready jobs. If he gives the go-ahead, the next day we'll start construction. And in these dire economic times, that sounds like an awful good deal. And it's strange. The president seems to, when he means shovel-ready jobs, he seems to only mean those that are in politically favored industries like wind and solar power. And so it's curious. And the moreover, politically favored industries that require billions of dollars of subsidies to stay alive, vis-a-vis this industry, that of oil and gas and this infrastructure logistics that provides a product that people actually want to buy of their own volition. So, I really think it's a matter of this difference between words and deeds. This notion of shovel-ready, that's ultra-important by the president's own account. So I think that we've already seen job losses. I mean, 60, which is nothing to nothing to sneeze at. And more importantly, I mean, there's 5,000 to 6,000 jobs in a holding pattern that could be created in one fell swoop with just a getting the government out of the way.
What do you make of the of Speaker Boehner, though, saying that everything's on the table, including attaching this to the payroll tax cut extension? Is that should anything go as far as this pipeline is concerned?
Well, there's two courses of action that the House, the majority party in the House, could take. On the one hand, they could try to attach this, to make this issue come up every 2 months. They can attach it to legislative priorities for the president, for example, the payroll tax cut, and force the president to make this uncomfortable decision repeatedly in the run-up to the election. Now, that would be sort of a tit-for-tat. I mean, it's widely perceived, again, the president's decision was politically motivated. That would certainly be a politically motivated decision by the House leadership. They could also pursue legislation that has been offered by Lee Terry, a representative from Nebraska, who actually represents the area through which this pipeline would cross. This legislation would take the decision out of the president's hand and give it to FERC, the Federal Electricity Reliability Council, and in essence give FERC a mandate to either approve or deny the pipeline, again, using the same criteria, that of the national interest, within 30 days. So if they wanted to go gung-ho, and as I understand it, that the Congress would have the constitutional authority to trump the president's decision-making on this interstate pipeline. That's the latest legal analysis that I read was to that effect. So if they wanted to go all out, they could do that. It strikes me as more likely that they'll choose the political route, the route the president chose, and attempt to keep this in the limelight, attempt to make the president make this uncomfortable decision, to say the least, repeatedly in the run-up to the 2012 election.
We are talking with William Yeatman, Assistant Director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. The Competitive Enterprise Institute supports the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. This is the pipeline that President Obama delayed, blocked last week, saying there wasn't enough time to assess the project. We are hearing a case for the Keystone Pipeline. In this half hour, we will hear a case against the pipeline in our second half hour. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for both of our guests at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. It's going to become mostly sunny today. We can expect high temperatures statewide to be in the 20s. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. 20 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, January the 24th. We're taking a look for and against the Keystone XL pipeline project during this hour, based on comments from House Speaker John Boehner on Sunday, saying that Republicans may again attach the Keystone XL oil pipeline to an extension of the payroll tax cut. And we're wondering what thoughts and questions you have about this project and President Obama last week blocking the project, saying he did not have enough time to approve it. And our first caller is Cindy in Burlington. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I'm kind of for this pipeline, you know, but I have the environmental issues and stuff like that. But what I'm against is that this oil is not even for us. It's for China, India, and other countries. So you're going to put these jobs out there, these little bit of jobs, for something that's going to happen that, you know, if that oil was for us, it would actually bring our gas prices down and stimulate our economy. And it would help, would actually give us more jobs, because if people have money in their pockets, they can go out and they can buy things, you know, and then it would actually stimulate our economy or bring our prices down for everything.
Yeah, and you're saying this oil is not going to benefit us, Cindy?
No, it's not going to benefit us. I looked it up, and it's just like it's going to China and it's going to India.
Yeah, what about that, William Yeatman?
Well, Cindy, thank you for that great question. I please beg you to take a look at that website I run, globalwarming.org, for a post by my colleague Marla Lewis. He highlights an Energy Department memo released late last week that debunks these two talking points bandied about against the pipeline. The first, that somehow this crude oil would pass through the United States to the Gulf and then be exported to China. Unequivocally, that's not the case. I mean, it doesn't really make a great deal of sense when you think about it, that oil would go 1,700 miles to the Gulf and then another, you know, well, all the way across the world to China. So there's no real, well, actually, there's no truth to that claim whatsoever. And please check out the post for that memo. With respect to the gasoline prices, that's another talking point bandied about by opponents of the pipeline, that they assert that there is in essence, we have refining regions in this country. One is located in the Midwest, one is located in the East Coast, and one is located in the Gulf of Mexico. The opponents of the pipeline argue that there's currently a glut of crude oil in our refining hub in the Midwest. They say that this pipeline, by bypassing the Midwest, would basically mitigate this glut and thereby increase gasoline prices in the Midwest. However, again, in that post I mentioned by my colleague Marla Lewis on globalwarming.org, this Energy Department memo makes clear that gasoline prices in the Midwest hub are actually set by marginal prices on the East Coast and the Gulf. the upshot being that a surplus, a glut of Canadian oil to the Gulf would actually lower gas prices countrywide, including the Midwest. So those are two, again, those are widely repeated notions, that of this crude going directly to China, that there's no truth to that, and that it would also somehow, by increasing the supply of crude and increasing the supply of our refining output, that it would somehow increase gas prices. That there's also no truth to that. So for the underlying document, please check out globalone.org and the post by my colleague Marla Lewis.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Michael on Facebook writes, maybe this fall, when we have had continuing blackouts in much of the U.S. because of Obama's EPA shutdown of 20 coal-fired generating plants, gas prices topping $4 per gallon, and the Canadians selling their oil to China instead of us, all as a result of Obama killing this pipeline, people will come to their senses. Is Michael predicting the future correctly there, William Yeatman?
Well, Michael, it's an interesting question. It's probably hyperbolic. I'll note this much, that there are, thanks to two huge regulations, and I would argue unnecessary regulations, and that's a whole different issue. I do beg you to check out the website, globalwarming.org. We address these in detail. The mercury and air toxics rule and the cross-state air pollution rule, there will be significant shutdowns of coal-fired generation in the United States. Whether or not this will engender reliability concerns in the near term, we don't yet know. The EPA doesn't know. The federal government doesn't know. That's because that sort of analysis is performed by regional transmission organizations. So that's the independent service operators that maintain the transmission lines, those big metallic lattices that you see on the highway. So with respect to the reliability concerns, it's a big question mark. We do know that electricity prices will increase. Will there be blackouts? Again, we don't know. But those are disassociated, those issues, from that of this Keystone Pipeline. I mean, we're talking about, I guess, different sectors of the energy economy. That the pipeline pertains to our transportation sector. We're using that oil in cars, whereas the coal-fired power plants and the EPA regs pertain largely to the electricity sector, so your power plants and whatnot.
Let me ask you, though, with what the president did last week, are now the Canadians going to sell their oil to China instead of us?
Who knows? In all honesty, that's another big question mark. What we do know, unequivocally, is that this tar sands oil in Alberta, Western Canada, will be developed. Now, whether or not it is piped into the U.S., whether or not it is piped to the west coast of Canada and exported to China, or whether or not there's some hybrid whereby they truck it out, pipeline it out, train it out, no matter what the logistics, the Canadian government is dedicated to developing this resource. They see it as a national priority. So whether or not it goes to China, whether or not it goes to us, wherever it goes, and my mind is that ultimately that the president made a political decision, he punted until after the election, and that I can't imagine that he would overturn this pipeline. Like, given, if nothing else, because it's such a priority of our closest, of Canada, our closest. I mean, you can't spurn your neighbor and your best ally like that. That's my humble opinion. But it's going to go somewhere. So if not the U.S., then yes, likely China. But that's a whole other ball of wax. I mean, that entails building a pipeline to the West Coast, which is a long-term project, something that's probably in Canada's national interest to begin with, just because demand for oil is exploding.
Our next caller is Gary in Boscobel. Hi, Gary. We're short on time. If you can be as brief as you can.
Well, I have a house that is in the Sandhills, and you can see where the pipeline will go from our back porch. And one of the problems that happened there was that Keystone come in there in the beginning and threatened landowners with right of eminent domain if they wouldn't sell, which was a violation of federal law for another country to take U.S. citizens' land. And if the pipeline people would run that pipeline another 20 miles east into the soils that are more of a clay-based soil, you wouldn't have the impact on these fragile soils and the aquifer that's there. It seemed like it would be a simple thing to reroute that. But the people are concerned about their water supply, and the president has never said he was going to stop that pipeline. He's just put it on hold until a more logical, more or less environmentally sensitive route can be found.
Right. Thank you very much, Gary. So just reroute it a little bit, William Yeatman.
Well, I mean, I do believe that's going to be part and parcel of the new application by TransCanada. And I will note, ever so briefly, Jerry brought up a great point. I work for, again, a libertarian outfit, so we're loath to, it's eminent domain is a big issue for us. Of course, it's in the Constitution. However, this nation's history, that of eminent domain power is rife with abuse. So that's a sticky wicket, and I certainly sympathize. As to whether or not there's going to be a rerouting, who knows? I mean, again, TransCanada has to reapply, and we'll know exactly what the new route would be or the proposed route would be when they do so.
We have just a minute to go. You are expecting that President Obama, after the election, presuming he is reelected, will approve this Keystone Pipeline.
That's my gut feeling. That is, I mean, I couldn't imagine, and that's, I used to be a student of international relations, so this is primarily, and this is divorced from the beneficial economic impacts, divorced from the environmental concerns. I think at the end of the day, this is a number one priority for our best buddies on the global stage, and for us to spurn them, I think would be unprecedented, and I can't imagine you'd do that.
Thank you very much for being with us. William Yeatman, Assistant Director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. It supports the Keystone XL pipeline. Coming up after we check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, we will welcome in a guest from the Natural Resources Defense Council's International Program, who is not a fan of the Keystone Pipeline, and we'll find out why and continue to take your calls after we check this news. Do you support or oppose the Keystone oil pipeline, and why? Which weighs heavier on your mind, the job growth or protecting the environment? Do you think President Obama was right or wrong in denying a permit for the pipeline last week, but encouraging the company TransCanada to reapply? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 7:36 on this Tuesday, January the 14th. We just heard a case for the Keystone Pipeline in our first half hour from a guest from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, who claimed that this project was important for the United States in terms of the jobs created and our national interests and our relationship with Canada. And he also said that President Obama delayed this decision or denied this permit for political reasons, not really for environmental concerns. Now we will get a different perspective on this issue. Anthony Swift, attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council's International Program, joins us. And again, you can join us, too, with your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Anthony Swift joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. It's great to be on the show.
Thanks very much for being with us. Well, let me just get your reaction first to what President Obama did last week by saying, no, I don't have enough time to make a decision on this a pipeline right now, but encouraging the company to reapply.
Well, I think it was the only choice the president could make. I mean, right now, despite what we're hearing from certain members of Congress, nobody in the United States can draw a route for this pipeline. The pipeline route through Nebraska has been scrapped, and a new one hasn't even been proposed, let alone approved. And there's still significant issues that need to be considered, both on the environmental impact of the new route through Nebraska and also concluding the national interest determination to ensure that, you know, the decision that is made is truly in the country's interest.
Mm-hmm. We were prompted to talk about this issue once again when we heard that House Speaker John Boehner on Fox News Sunday was saying that Republicans may attach the pipeline proposal to an extension of the payroll tax cut. Once again, that everything is on the table. He really is going to do whatever he has to do, he says, to get this thing approved as soon as possible. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think Representative Boehner's arguments have really focused on Keystone XL as a national jobs package, and it really isn't. Even TransCanada, the pipeline sponsor, has acknowledged that the pipeline will create no more than a few hundred permanent jobs, and you know, somewhere in the vicinity of 6,000 short-term construction jobs over the 2 years that the pipeline is constructed. So, really, there are bigger issues at stake, such as is Keystone XL in the national interest? And if you look at the facts, it's very hard to make the case that it is.
Yeah, why wouldn't it be?
Well, if you look at the argument is we need this pipeline for energy security. But the problem with that argument is Canada, Western Canada, already has 4 million barrels of pipeline capacity going to the U.S., and they have less than 2 million barrels of oil to fill it. So there's no oil on the Canadian side of the border to put in a new pipeline. In fact, the pipelines that are coming from Canada are already running half empty. So what Keystone XL will do is it will essentially divert oil that was moving on pipelines to the U.S. Midwest and send it to the Gulf. And, you know, I did listen to the previous discussion, but if you look at the Gulf Coast, and this is relying only on both the Gulf Coast refiners and TransCanada's own testimony, the Gulf Coast is moving toward a export model. They, you know, the U.S. exports 3 million barrels of oil a day in the form of refined products to international buyers. The refiners that are most interested in the crude from Keystone XL are configuring their refineries to cater to the international market. And TransCanada itself told Canadian regulators when it was going through the Canadian regulatory process that Keystone XL would increase oil prices in the U.S. by somewhere between $2 to $4 billion a year. And again, that's not our analysis. That's TransCanada's.
Mm-hmm. Our other guest also said that this project has been reviewed for years. I think he said 3 years, and that there is no environmental risk. Is there or isn't there?
There is, and one of the reasons, there you can review something for a long time, but if you don't review it well, it the time you spend reviewing it doesn't really matter. And every time, I mean, the State Department has been the one running the environmental review. They are not particularly experienced in reviewing these sorts of projects. And at every point that the State Department issued an environmental assessment of Keystone XL, EPA and in some cases the Department of Energy and other agencies have found those assessments inadequate. So one of the reasons that it's taken so long is really it hasn't been done well. And even now the State Department's Investigator General is evaluating the process by which the review came out and is looking at the contractor, Cardinal Intrix, that did the review on behalf of State Department and evaluating whether there are conflicts of interest. Cardinal Intrix at one point was listing TransCanada as one of its primary clients at the time that it was preparing an environmental impact statement for State Department that would decide whether Keystone XL would go forward or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the major environmental concern?
Well, what will be moving in Keystone XL is not conventional crude, not the oil that we expect, the oil that's being produced in Texas and North Dakota. It's a tarry substance that actually by itself is too thick to move through pipelines, so they mix it with natural gas liquids to thin it out. The process to produce that tar, you end up clear-cutting massive swaths of forest, huge amounts of water is expended in the process and ends up in these contaminated tailing ponds. There's, I think, about 80 square miles of these contaminated tailing ponds in Canada now. And that, they're finding, is beginning to poison the water supply. It's been linked to increased cancer rates by the local populations. And it's an incredibly energy-intensive process, and in the end, it results in much higher emissions. And the tar itself, it's energy-intensive to refine, and it creates greater, you end up with more toxic byproducts in the end of the refining process. And more to the point, if you look at the pipeline itself, there are serious concerns about the safety of this particular substance in pipelines. Just last year, our U.S. pipeline safety regulators testified to Congress that they couldn't assure that all the risks associated with what's called raw tar sands have been adequately addressed by pipeline safety regulations. In fact, the agency hasn't really studied that. And the one major diluted bitumen or raw tar sand spill that we've had, which is just next door to you guys in Kalamazoo, Michigan, has turned into a disaster for cleanup. EPA is running that cleanup, and they've said that they've never seen anything like it. The much of the oil basically sank into the water column and has proven incredibly difficult to pull out. The cleanup costs have increased to $700 million now, and it's still a mess. So there are significant problems with the transport of this stuff, and of course the raw crude tar sands itself is some of the highest emitting petroleum in the world.
Yeah. So it doesn't sound like even if TransCanada said, "Well, here's a different route," that you would approve of this.
Well, one of the problems with the route that TransCanada approved is it went through the heart of the Ogallala Aquifer, where an area called the Sandhills, where much of the U.S. groundwater is nationally concentrated, and it was a very ill chosen route, of course. And so, for one thing, that's why Nebraska had such difficulties with it. But even if the route is moved, there are still significant problems with the project, both on the environmental side and based on the fact that TransCanada and Enbridge, they're both Canadian pipeline companies, have indicated that this pipeline is going to increase the cost of shipping crude to the U.S. and the cost of Canadian crude in U.S. markets.
We have many callers, and I want to get to them quickly, but our last guest was fairly convinced that President Obama just punted this decision to be made after the presidential election, and presuming if he's reelected, he will approve this Keystone Pipeline project. Do you agree?
No, I think that, as I said, if you look at the actual facts associated with this pipeline, it doesn't bring any energy supply to the U.S. for another 15 to 20 years. It's got significant environmental issues, and our regulatory system isn't ready for this kind of crude in a pipeline. I think there are many reasons to find that it's not in the national interest. And, just because it's in Canada's interest doesn't mean it's in the U.S.'s interest.
Our guest is Anthony Swift, attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council's International Program, giving us the case against the Keystone XL pipeline. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. One open line at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Becoming mostly sunny today with highs statewide in the 20s. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 8, it's another edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be in, and we'll find out if he thinks we ought to hurry up or wait on mortgage refinancing. Also tonight, a reminder, at 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network, we will bring you NPR news coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address, plus the Republican response from Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels. State of the Union special tonight at 8 here on the Ideas Network. All morning long tomorrow, between 6 and 9, we will bring you many different perspectives, analysts and commentators and lawmakers with reaction and discussion about the State of the Union. To your calls now for Anthony Swift. He is an attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council's International Program, talking about the Keystone Pipeline. And our first caller is Steve in Milwaukee. Hello, Steve.
Yeah, I just think that, I understand the environmentalist idea, but to make the argument that this pipeline hasn't been studied or this pipeline is dangerous to natural resources or anything else, I mean, there's over 2,500 miles of pipe currently flowing through that aquifer. And TransCanada is probably the best energy and safest energy company in the world. The tar sands are going to be developed. And to say it doesn't affect Americans, it won't help Americans, it's just wrong. I mean, right here in Wisconsin, Michael's Contracting would have the lion's share of the contract. And, I mean, we're going to use oil. We're going to have oil. And, you know, if you want to talk about oil from the Middle East, I mean, I'd rather have oil sands oil.
All right. Anthony Swift?
Well, that's a good point. First, on TransCanada's record, I will say TransCanada has only had one crude oil pipeline that is wholly owned and operated, and that's its first Keystone pipeline. And that pipeline leaked 14 times in its first year of operation and is actually the newest pipeline to have been shut down by regulators as an imminent threat to public health and safety. So I'm not sure TransCanada's record really speaks for itself in that regard. And as far as the Ogallala Aquifer, one of the chief concerns was that the pipeline goes through the Sandhills region, which is where the majority of the water in the aquifer is focused, even though it's a very large aquifer. And right now there aren't any crude oil pipelines through the Sandhills. But again, we don't know what route will be chosen through Nebraska, so it's hard to talk to it with much specificity. But on to the larger point, there is no question that a job is a job. But again, when you look at the fact that even the companies that are sponsoring this project indicate that it will increase oil prices in the U.S., that has an impact in economic growth and job creation. And the real key way for us to kind of reduce our dependence on the oil market is to reduce the amount of crude that we use. And we've already made great strides in that regard. We actually use about 2 million barrels a day less than we did just 5 or 6 years ago. And through making more efficient cars, more efficient vehicles, more efficient combustion engines, we can further reduce our crude oil use by as much as 5.7 million barrels a day by 2030. And that would create additional American jobs, and we could begin to export our technologies and our products rather than importing products from other countries.
Thank you, Steve, for the call. I'm told that we have a dignitary on line three. We have the mayor of Racine, John Dickert, with us, who is apparently Mayor Dickert opposed to this pipeline.
Yes, actually, thank you, Joy, and good morning, everyone. Actually, Mayor Hosterman, Mayor Coing, and myself penned a letter to the president and to the State Department early on in the pipelines issue. And let me put it in layman's terms, if I may, for a lot of the listeners to understand. As the attorney pointed out, when you take tar sands and put it into a pipe, at the high pressure that they do, and they don't clean the tar sands, so you're basically using small rocks and sand to sandblast the inside of a pipe at a high pressure with high acidity. So the reason that the attorney has pointed out that there's 14 breaks is I think anybody who's familiar with any kind of physics or even any kind of basic mechanics understands if you sandblast the inside of a pipe at high pressure for a long time, eventually that pipe is going to burst. The problem is when the pipe bursts, it also spills an immense amount of this very high acetic oil all over our land. And that is why one of the reasons that the mayor has opposed this pipeline, and we're glad that the president has pushed this off. There simply is not enough information. There is not enough proven safety for American citizens. And even though this doesn't run through any of our states that are opposing this, we're concerned about the American public.
Yes, thank you very much for the call. And I understand that Mayor John Dickert is one of 103 mayors to sign this letter against the pipeline. Anthony Swift?
No, I think that that's exactly right. And, you know, talking about how much study has been done in regard to this pipeline, no one on the Canadian side or the U.S. side, no regulator and the companies involved, haven't evaluated, A, the impacts of this particular crude on pipelines, and also, you know, the risks that occur when it spills. I mean, EPA is trying to figure it out in dealing with the Kalamazoo spill. Congress has recently passed a pipeline safety bill that will require pipeline regulators to begin to evaluate the risks that this pose and, you know, how to deal with them. But the simple fact of the matter is we don't have that system in place. And, you know, you build a pipeline before you know what your risks are, and you're really courting trouble.
Thanks again for the call. David on Facebook writes, the same people who constantly bemoan the loss of low-skilled jobs that pay a living wage are the same people who put up roadblocks for new ones that don't have to be propped up by the government. Energy utopia is not coming anytime soon, probably not in our lifetimes. A reaction to that?
Well, I mean, I think that the key thing is that Keystone XL is really not a national job creator. We're looking at a relatively small-scale number of jobs over a relatively short period. And what we really need to be focused on as a nation are the sort of initiatives that are massive national job creators. And there's a real opportunity cost when Congress focuses on something like that instead of really creating jobs to put millions of Americans back to work.
Time for, I think, a last caller, Joe in Milwaukee. Hello, Joe.
Hi. You know, you were just talking about how energy-intensive this process is, the extraction of the oil and shipping it down through the... What is the net energy gain that we get from that oil?
You know, I don't have the statistics with me on hand. I mean, I apologize for that, but I my understanding is that you use about a third of the energy that's in the tar sands just to produce, you know, just through the natural gas to get it out of the rock, and the refining process is additionally energy intensive. So you're not, I mean, the gains you get from this crude are much smaller than conventional sources.
Well, I know that environmentalists were cheering the president's decision last week. But it doesn't sound like this issue is over and done with.
Well, it is alive in the political sphere anyway. But I should make a point that the permit application has been denied, and if TransCanada wants to reapply, they'll have to put forward a new permit for a new pipeline. So, to some extent, The pipeline that we know as Keystone XL is dead. There may be another application that, you know, by similar parties to make a similar pipeline, but for the moment we're kind of in the larger debate of whether we need more supply and where to get it.
Well, we'll leave it there for now. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Joy.
Anthony Swift, attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council's International Program, talking with us about this Keystone Pipeline issue. In our first half hour, we heard from a guest from the Competitive Enterprise Institute speaking in favor of the Keystone Pipeline, William Yateman. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing the program and for on-air direction as well. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come, and I hope that you will tune in tonight at 8 for live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address, plus the Republican response from Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels. NPR's coverage starts at 8 o'clock tonight. Tomorrow night, by the way, at 7 o'clock, it's Governor Walker's State of the State address. This is the Ideas Network.